Larry Horwitz joins me this week to discuss wit beer and light lagers. This is Beersmith Podcast number 285.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 285, and it's late July 2023. Larry Horwitz joins me this week to discuss wit beer and light lager. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The American Homebrewers Association invites you to choose your own brew venture. Join for 1 year and select a free brewing book from more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit thehomebrewersassociation.org/beersmith to join the American Homebrewers Association and get your new brewing book. Again, the special link is homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith. And Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith software. Beersmith for the Web lets you brew great recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with access to the same full suite of building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like and subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking those buttons is a great way to support the show. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Larry Horwitz from Crooked Hammock Brewery. Larry has served as a board member for the Brewers Association and president of the NBAA for two districts. He chairs the Draft Beer Quality Subcommittee for the BA and is a judge for both GABF and World Beer Cup. Larry is currently the head brewer at Crooked Hammond. Larry, it's great to have you on the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Brad. How about you? You enjoying your summer?
It's a pleasure. Yeah, it's a nice day. People might note on the video, I'm coming from a remote location, undisclosed remote location here. So,
yeah,
you just made it home, right?
Yeah, I did. We had a busy day today, and it's funny. And my wife's at the pool, so I swung by for just a hot second. She's like, "Get in the pool." I'm like, "Oh, I get to talk to Brad now." that's awesome.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to be here. And
my pleasure.
It's great to have you on, first time guest. So I thought I might start by just asking you a little bit about your background. You've got some 30 years in over 30 years in brewing, right?
Yeah, this 1992 was my first year in the industry as a commercial brewer. So we're just a hair over 30 right now, which is kind of scary to think about, right?
Like, yeah,
you know, I was talking to an old friend of mine today. So Jim Lutz works for a draft install company here in the Mid-Atlantic called AC Beverage, and Jim famously, you know, ran Flying Dog for a minute and owned Wild Goose for a while. In any case, been in the Mid-Atlantic beer business for a long time, and it's his birthday tomorrow, and we were, you know, we get to stop for a second and reflect about how long we were in the business. And his wife, who's a lovely woman, said, "Well, what's different?" And I'm like, "Well, pretty much everything." I think there were 600 breweries in America maybe in 1992. I'm going to get that number wrong, but it was small enough that everybody knew everybody, right?
Yeah.
And you know, I joke a little bit, tongue planted in cheek, that, you know, I manage a great group of younger men, not boys certainly. And every once in a while they're like, "Well, it couldn't have been that much harder." And Jim actually said to one of them today, he's like, "We literally had to invent a lot of the stuff that you guys take for granted." And I'm like, yeah, that's a great way to talk about it, you know.
I mean, that is true. I started in 1987, and most of the knowledge, things like IBUs and color and all this other stuff that we take for granted, you can estimate now, none of that existed at that time. Most of that research was done in the early 1990s.
Oh yeah, I mean, the research that existed was all around, you know, 8.5 Plato, 10 IBU lager beer, and mostly focused on how to make it faster and cheaper.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, And the Japanese were doing some fun stuff. And you know, if you could read German, then you could get a copy of Kunze or maybe even the De Klerk books and learn how beer was made in Southern Germany. But other than that, you know, people like Ken Grossman and Fritz Maytag and the folks at Full Sail and on the East Coast, you know, Ches Bay and Alan Young and that group were literally inventing I don't want to say they invented how to make beer or we invented how to make beer. It's that, you know, the industry was not targeted at customers our size, right? Like, you know, if you didn't have a rail siding to unload malt, how did you get malt, right? You know, you had to find somebody who would either give you a little bit out of their silos, plural, or their rail siding. Or, you know, when Roger Brees started to bag, at the urging of Marianne Gruber, started to bag malt in Chilton, Wisconsin, and would sell it to small brewers, it was a huge deal. You know, I joked with somebody recently who was humping a bunch of 50-pound sacks, because we have silos at two of our larger locations. Like, ah, man, I had to move like 20 bags of grain today. I'm like, yeah, we used to have to take half truckloads bags just to get them delivered, you know, months of malt. And we would unload them by hand on the side cobble road into a basement. And then everything had to come back up out of the basement by hand, you know. And he was like, yeah, the uphill both ways in the snow, right?
Yeah.
I think the biggest change is just the sheer number of brewers, right? And I mean, that sounds obvious, but it's interesting. You know, the Brewers Association has a statistic that, and I don't remember the mileage number, but it's in the single digits. Like some shocking number of Americans live within about 10 miles of a brewery. And a bunch of us live within 10 miles of a bunch of breweries. And I think that's amazing. And I'm for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think I looked up the numbers the other day. I think it was on the order of 9,400 breweries, roughly, in the U.S. now. Pretty big
number.
Sounds
right. I talk to the people at the Brewers Association regularly for all kinds of reasons, and often to Dr. Bart Watson, who's their economist. And, you know, I'm like, what's the number today? And he's like, you know, we think it's somewhere around 9,840. But they can't nail the number. They have an entire group of people who spend a substantial portion of their workday just calling breweries to find out if they're open, right? Yeah. Breweries that either were closing or maybe closed or maybe opened or maybe didn't or maybe closed and then opened. And so that's interesting, you know. Yeah. You know, in the early 90s, if a brewery opened two states away, we all would get in the truck and schlep over there, right?
Yep.
Like, great, somebody else.
Well, Larry, today you wanted to talk about wit beer and light lagers, and I thought maybe we'd start with wit beer. Can you start by telling us a little bit about the style and what makes it unique?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll go full stats nerd on you for just a second, which
that's okay.
You know, because of Keith Vila and Blue Moon, that particular style has become one of the number one selling IRI craft SKUs in America, right? And I'm excited about that for a lot of reasons. One, that group, you know, say what you want about big breweries or not. They do a great job of making a really interesting beer and of introducing it to a lot of people who've never seen it before. And I've made, or we've made, a product in that vein for, you know, probably 2.5 decades at this point. I think I made my first one in 96 or 97. The style, of course, originates from the town of Hoegaarden, right? Where basically this was field beer, right? Beer for the city. And, you know, Pierre Celis famously, after the style, of course, did what so many Western European styles did, you know, kind of just became obsolete for all the reasons, you know, businesses go under because small family breweries don't have an heir apparent to run the brewery, or, you know, and pressures from world wars. And then, of course, economic pressures in the 80s and 90s. My introduction to wit beer was from Pierre, who's no longer with us. But, you know, he was given a talk somewhere around Columbus, Ohio. I don't even remember the exact location anymore because it doesn't exist. It was turned into an arena. And, you know, here's this, you know, very nice man who's trying to resurrect the style of the town that he grew up in. And I would say he succeeded based on the information that, you know, the number one IRI craft SKU in America is a wit beer, right? So this is farmhand beer, right? This is, you know, famously made with not just malted barley, but usually with raw wheat and Also famously flaked oats. I mean, common breweries today are using flaked oats for the haze reason, which I think is interesting, right? Because, you know, it's a group at Louvain that does all the research, I think in the early 2000s, to figure out that the haziest grain you can put in your beer is oat, right? It has all the haze precursors and all the long chain polysaccharides, proteins, and fats that give a beer haze. And for most of my career, we worked really hard to make beer that wasn't hazy. And right. We'll talk about that whole thing in just a minute. So, you know, Pierre's resurrection of the style is famously spiced with coriander and bitter and sweet orange peel. And there, you know, I think a lot of people miss the idea that these were small producers, not just farmhouse breweries, but even small commercial breweries. So the spices that went into the whip beer, especially around the town of Hoegaarden, and I can't remember the number, but I think there were 7 or 8 breweries in the town when it was in its heyday, didn't all use the same spices. I joke with the young men who work with and for me that, you know, they're like, well, this is a traditional whip beer. And I'm like, well, I agree with you, but which tradition? You know, I think this is great. You know, the gentleman who wrote the What About Barclay Perkins book, he did the deep dive and all the British brew logs. Why can't I think of his name right now? But in any case, I think that the research that he did, I'm sure I've got the book on the shelf. We'll get his name in a little bit. But
Ron Pattinson.
Yep, Ron Pattinson. So
Ron's had him on a number of times, actually.
Oh, that's great. I need to meet Ron. Ron did this thing, which I thought was amazing. He went to a brewery, and I'm coming back to whip beer, I promise. Ron went to Barclay Perkins and a few other British breweries, and I think there's something about the collegial nature of our industry that's amazing. Brewers talk to each other, and we share secrets. I mean, there's always a few people who keep things tucked in their pocket, you know, but we talk to each other because I think we all kind of tacitly understand that we're better together, right? And so Ron does this thing where he goes and looks at just one beer from this brewery, and you can see the iteration over generations, right? And so I find it interesting that especially in America, craft brewers say, well, I want to make a traditional British bitter, right? and he's really shown a light on the fact that, well, from what decade or what year or what brewery or what latitude?
Yeah, Ron was telling me that, you know, the bitters changed during the interwar years, and they also changed even when they started raising taxes, for example.
Oh, yeah, totally, right? But the idea, which I think he has illuminated for us, is that, you know, beer moves, it changes throughout time. So when my team was putting together and developing the recipe for the whip beer, I got to talk to my group and be like, they're like, well, we're going to make a traditional whip beer. And I'm like, well, which tradition, right? I mean, you know, where we ended up is in the Pierre Celis interpretation of whip beer, right? Which I think is pretty commonly held now. And I really enjoy that style with, you know, with a really beautiful Pilsner malt as the base, white North American wheat malt. I'm a fan of that. I think the red wheat is sweet and round and soft, but there's something about the white wheat that I think just adds some character. Beer. I mean, it's a white beer, right? And then, of course, raw wheat and famously the spices of sweet and bitter orange peel and a little bit of coriander and our not so secret spice. We dip a little bit of grains of paradise in there because I think that adds some character to beer. But you know, it's interesting because we've gone through this cycle recently where everybody is kind of chasing strong hoppy beer, and I'm a fan. You know, I'm not going to judge too harshly. We have been trying to really tick back a little bit towards some more drinkable, sessionable, lighter traditional styles. I mean, you can see the hop fatigue in the market and why we still make and sell love beautiful hoppy beers. As a matter of fact, I had a New England IPA before we sat down. As a matter of fact, I did a very bad job of planning here. I should have brought a beer in. I can't drink 5 of those anymore. Not that anybody probably oughta, but there was a time in my life as a younger man where that was a relatively responsible evening. Can't do it anymore, right? And I think there are a lot of people out there who, whether they can or can't, is really not relevant. They want to drink beer that's a little bit different. We've seen a whole resurgence in craft breweries making lager beer, which we'll talk about here in a second. But I think it's the pendulum trying to swing back just a little bit, right?
Yeah, I mean, I find wit beer to be a very drinkable, enjoyable beer. And in fact, a lot of my friends enjoy, that aren't into craft beer, still can enjoy a wit beer, you know?
Oh, yeah. In the olden days of the 80s and 90s, we talked a lot about transition beers, right? You know, if your brewery only made 3 or 4 beers, which most of us only did because we had 1 or 2 or 4 fermenters, right? But we had to make a friend of mine made a beer they called Bill Payer Ale, right? I was a little on the nose, but also it was a good introduction to people who would walk into the pub, and, you know, tap rooms weren't really a thing there. We were mostly brewery restaurants in the craft beer industry if we weren't small microbreweries, and they'd say, well, can I get a Bud Light? Can I get a Miller Lite? Can I get a High Life? Can I get a Bud Heavy? You know, and the answer was, well, no, we make our own beer here. And they said, well, and the question's always, well, what do you have that's like that? And you know, the answer to that is a mixed bag, at least in late 80s and the early 90s, based on the kind of equipment that you could afford, and did you have the space and time to make lager? I think wit beer falls into an interesting space in between, right? It's still low in flavor impact, but complex. It's got sweet malty flavors, but enough dryness and spiciness to keep somebody who might enjoy one of those premium American lagers interested. So, you know, we don't really talk about it anymore internally as a transition product, but I really think it's great. You know, if my brother-in-law, who really likes to crush cans of Natural Light, can pick one up and say, yeah, that tastes pretty good, I think we're on the right path, right? You know, plus it's a sneaky seller. Our staff suddenly has drinking it, right? We're famously at the beach, right? And it's kind of tough to suck down a crowler of, you know, 100 IBU-ish West Coast IPA on a 95-degree day.
Well, let's dive into actually brewing one. And I guess I want to start with the grain bill. And you did talk about the use of unmalted wheat and oats, both very important here. Unmalted wheat, I find very interesting because it's really not that fermentable, right? And there's a large percentage used.
Yep. I mean, there's this interesting idea around hot American malt, right? So gone are the days when most of our grain bills include under-modified malt. You know, we buy premium domestic Pilsner malt, and it's still 120, 140 degrees, right? I mean, this stuff nearly glows in the dark with enzymatic power. So, you know, we all know that the alpha and beta amylase that are in our mashes mostly can't break down dextrins, right? Anything more than about 6 glucose units from the 1,6 bond in the starch molecule or the amylase or amylopectin molecule. But there's so much enzymatic power that we still get a pretty decent amount of starch conversion to extract. Or at the very least, we're getting solids that we're measuring.
Just out of curiosity, what percentage of unmalted wheat are you using?
We're around 25%. I think that it wants to be a pretty decent chunk of this grist bill. We're a little on the high side. We are 60% non base malt.
Wow, so you're using a lot of oats too, then, I guess.
Yeah, we are.
Because I brewed wit before with 40% unmalted wheat, but of course I don't use oats typically. So,
yeah, oats are interesting, right? I think that the flavor is pretty pronounced, and I used to keep the oat load down. Because for a long time, early in my career, we were really chasing clear beer almost all the time. Even in the unfiltered beers, people didn't want to see a sludgy beer. They didn't mind a nice haze in a Hefeweizen or a few of the Belgian styles where you would expect it. But as a rule, you didn't want a sludgy. So, you know, we kept the oat load down. But I think we all kind of understand that permanent haze is really reinforced by the use of oats. So, you know, we're buying it in large quantities now, especially for the New England IPA style. And so, you know, we leaned in a little bit and said, let's focus on the adjuncts for this beer. Plus, we have a couple of louder tons in our company that can take that beta-glucany mess, right? That's a big gummy mess. We do work a little bit with rice hulls. You know, everybody's got to get home at the end of the workday, right? And every once in a while, somebody's not paying close attention to the crush at the mill. We run into a problem. We're like, well, looks like it's going to be a 4-hour louder, right?
Yeah, it is. It is one of the stickier beers to mash. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. But knock wood, you know, we're coming out around 12 Plato. So, you know, we're not overloading our mash tuns. I think that there's a, I don't think I know this, that there's a geometry problem in most craft brewers mash louder combos, right? They tend to be made the size that the brewery equipment manufacturer thought was convenient for shipping and not necessarily convenient for brewing. You know, when the diameter of a louder tun is the same in your little brew house as the diameter of your brew kettle, I twitch a little bit. Right? And we have one brewery that has that geometry problem, and he's got to use rice hulls. He's got to use rice hulls.
What are your thoughts on yeast? I know some of them have a slightly phenolic take to them, almost approaching a Bavarian wit, and other ones are a lot cleaner.
I like personally, so I guess I don't want to speak for my whole team, although everybody seems to be drinking the beer. I like a fairly phenolic whipped beer. I want people to understand that there's a complex flavor here, right? So we're using the yeast that Pierre Salas used famously. It's available commonly and commercially at all the labs. You know, we buy it from 4 or 5 different sources, depending on availability and time of the year. But, you know, everybody, I think, is familiar with, I'm trying to think of it. Man, I can't remember the number. White Labs, I think it's WLP. Well, 500 is Chimay. It's maybe 530. Mm-hmm. But it's the Pierre Salas strain, which he got, you know, from, well, I don't remember where exactly he got it, but it seems that the lore is he got it from a bottle of beer somewhere in or around the town that he grew up in, or more likely, and this is probably the real story, it got nicked by one of the big yeast catalogs, right? So either it came from Weinstephan, who famously keeps that stuff, or maybe even the Bandiac catalog at Molson Miller Coors. There's a whole bunch of sneaky yeast libraries floating around the world. And I've been very fortunate that people will usually let us in on that. It's again, it's 30 years later. And now if you need yeast, you don't have to drive 2 hours up the road to borrow some from the commercial brewer who's a friend of yours. You just pick up the phone and stuff shows up in 2 days. And it's really high quality. I'm waiting for someone, and I can't believe I'm going to say this out loud, because if you'd have told me I was going to say this 30 years ago, I would tell you you're crazy. We have started to spend more time experimenting with and using regularly the really stunningly high quality commercial dry yeast that is suddenly available. I mean, I think we all read Charlie's book or other publications early in our home brewing and commercial brewing careers that basically said, take the yeast that's on the can and throw it away. Right.
You know, well, I mean, back in the 90s, that was a good advice, but as you point out, the quality of the dry yeast is substantially better now.
It's shocking, actually. And I'm glad about that. That's innovation I didn't expect in our industry. I'm pretty stoked about it. So we traditionally, we use the Pierre Salas strain of Hoegaarden whipped beer yeast. One thing that I do that a lot of other people don't do is we ferment that beer very warm. I'm leaning into the phenolic, and I do one other thing that accentuates the ester package, which is we use about 5% dextrose in the beer. I think it has two things happen when we do that I love. One of them is it helps with the attenuation, right? It is my opinion, and the opinion of some pretty famous people in the beer world, that the degree of apparent attenuation is a pretty good indicator of the drinkability of beer, right? I think that, you know, we all know about this idea that a lot of homebrewers who are famously under-pitch yeast for the last 20 years or so, we're getting better about that, would get under-attenuated beer, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not necessarily a terrible thing. And we're talking about, I'm slicing hairs here a little bit, right? We're talking about the difference between 4 Plato and 2 Plato on 12 Plato beer. You know, so by percentage, a pretty decent amount, but we get variability just because fermentation is a biological process of plus or minus as much as a half a degree Plato, even on this beer. But I love using the dextrose because it thins out the body just a little bit. It punches the alcohol just a tiny bit. We don't use it for cost reasons. Somebody was harassing me about that. They're like, ah, you cheapen the beer when you put dextrose in it. I'm like, yeah, we pay $1 a pound for dextrose.
5% isn't that much either. So,
So
what about hops and spices? What are you using for hops and what kind of spices do you like to use?
So I love all of the Hallertau derivatives. I'm a noble hop guy, and this is a beer that I think really does a great job with a soft Western European noble variety. We are currently using Hallertau Mittelfrüh in the Whirlpool, just a tiny bit at a low enough threshold that it blends, in my opinion, nicely with the spices. And, you know, that hop tends to be subtle, a little cedar, in my opinion, a little wildflower. On the front end, I bitter almost exclusively with Columbus Tomahawk Zeus. We used to talk about those three hops separately, but because of a bunch of patent fights and the ability to do relatively inexpensive genetic work, I think we all kind of understand that that's all almost the same hop.
CTZ, yeah.
Yeah, you know, low cohumulone, high alpha. I try to keep the green matter low in the whirlpool and in the kettle here because we're looking for good yield. I think it provides a really nice, soft, fine bitterness. I am not of the school of thought that one should only use low alpha varieties for bittering. I think you can back yourself into a corner with that idea, right? I once made a Czech Pilsner and I said, I'm interested in this idea. It sounds great. Makes sense, right? So we're going to try it. And for a while in the early 2000s, I don't remember exactly when, but alpha acid on the noble hop varieties just bottomed out, right? Like we were getting Saz, I think, at like 2% alpha. And so we made this Czech Pilsner, and this was before the 4 pounds per barrel dry hop and 4 pounds per barrel of the Whirlpool days. And we lost like 20% of the beer to all this hop. And it tasted a little bit like fresh cut hay, which was interesting, but it wasn't what we were going for, right? I'm like, all right, I made that shift, and from my big beer days, I spent a lot of time using hop extracts and hop products and what, those high alpha varieties, which were mostly their product development was either paid for or asked for by the big brewers for economic reasons. But in this case, I think there's a really good flavor reason to use a low cohumulone, high alpha variety like that. I'm a fan of a few others. CTZ is super cost effective, and I actually happen to like the aroma of it. We use it sparingly as a makeup hop in some of our IPAs to keep the pine needle tea and the geranol flavors of that you get out of Cascade up. I think it does a nice job of punching up that American aroma. In this case, we're not using it in that way in this beer. So only two hop additions. Basically, we boil for 90 minutes. We use CTZ for bittering on the front end, just south of 20 BUs. I think on paper, we talk about it at 10, but we all know that the math bounces around a little bit. Perceived bitterness is firm but low. For spices, this is a great story. So obviously we're using coriander, and we're in a part of the world where there's a very famous spice importer, grinder, and manufacturer called McCormick. I won't name the group, but I worked with a group of people who fought with me over this for a while. They're like, listen, I want the coriander from the little Indian shop at the corner in my neighborhood. And I said, well, that's interesting, but we're professionals and we brew commercially, and we need trackability and traceability for the spices for safety reasons and for government regulation reasons. But more importantly, I don't know how long that coriander's been sitting in that store. This is a problem sometimes with small stores. And I have a friend who works for McCormick. Obviously we're a brew pub group. And at that time I worked for a different brew pub group. And we bought a lot of food from companies that bought a lot of spices from McCormick. McCormick's in Baltimore. And my friend said, hey, we've got a flavor guy. Why don't we bring him out and we'll panel a bunch of coriander? And I'm like, yes, I'm totally here. So he said, listen, send your guy to his favorite store. Everybody go out in the world, find coriander, right? And this is quite a while ago. These days, I can buy really beautiful coriander from two or three of my major suppliers, but I'm still using, I'm going to cut to the end for 1 second. I'm still using McCormick coriander, but we'll come back to that. So he came to us and he brought some beautiful spice grinders and some flavor kits. And we did a little sensory analysis, a little sensory training, which I always love. Anytime I can add value to my team, that way it's fun. And he said, so I'm gonna make preparations of the 9 or 10 different corianders that we have here. And he set it out. And then you know how this goes, right? It's the French wine paradox. Everybody starts fighting over which coriander is their coriander, right? And I'm like, cut it out. We're not trying to see who won here. We're trying to find the best coriander. So we worked our way through the entire thing. And it turns out that the winning coriander is the pre-ground McCormick's that actually came out of the kitchen in the restaurant we were in that day. And you know, a lot of the team was really incredulous. Like, man, I'm kind of disheartened by that. And I'm like, well, don't be. There are two good takeaways here. One is that we've got access responsibly and easily to really stunning coriander. And then the guy from McCormick flipped the bottle over and he's like, this spice was ground 2 weeks. Yeah. I think a lot of people don't think about the idea that a spice has a shelf life, right? Ground spice even lower. So we are still buying pre-ground McCormick, usually through one of our food purveyors, but it's available to us commercially in commercial quantities. I get it. And I think right now in roughly 10 barrel batch of our wheat beer, we're using around 2 pounds of this coriander. And it is just beautiful, brilliant, lemony product and extremely consistent. And, you know, I think that not to plug that company too shamelessly, because they can pat themselves on their own back, but their buyers source really beautiful stuff. And I don't currently know where they're getting it, but I know that they're good at that, and we're stoked about that. So for awesome. For bitter orange peel, we use Curacao. I buy it from. It's available for a lot of places. We're not here to plug other businesses necessarily on the show, but I enjoy Atlantic Spice or San Francisco Spice Company. I believe it's the same company, and they resell to a couple of my suppliers. They put out two kinds of orange on the sweet side that I really like. But you know, just the orange, the navel orange peel dried is really great. And then bitter. The crazy bad liqueur is blue, right? The bitter Curacao orange peel, we use a decent amount of that too. And I think we might be up to even a pound a barrel for that. So there's a pretty substantial spice load in these products. But I want people to feel that. I mean, we try to make sure they're balanced in a way where, you never want to drink a beer where it's like flavor. If we've really done a good job.
It's fairly subtle, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you were kind enough to send some of the beer along and I enjoyed it. It was really, really nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
In the interest of time, though, we probably have to switch over to light lager and discuss. You wanted to discuss your light lager. And so let's talk about that. What, how is this style, really different than a Pilsner, for example?
Well, I will say we also make Pilsner. But, one of the things that my company asked me to do when I came on board is they're like, listen, we're ready to innovate a little bit. And we'd like to change the portfolio of beers we're making. And that's always a fun project. So I said, listen, we're going to start with American Premium. And after some focus group work and talking to people interior, they're like, we had this desire, not just amongst the regular employees of the company, but also the brew staff. They're like, can you please build for us a craft light beer? And I said, I have a lot of experience doing this. I would love to do that. And I said, well, why? And the answer was, we're at the beach, and we get a lot of first timers, a lot of one timers who come in and they're interested in the experience and they want to be in a brewery, and that's awesome. But they need a little help to figure out what we're doing, and they'll walk right up to the bar and say, hey, can I get a name your favorite mass market beer? And that's always a conversation, which is, hey, we appreciate what those breweries are doing, but we are a brewery, and if you went to Golden, Colorado, to the Coors plant, they probably wouldn't serve my beer there. And I don't feel, I understand that. I said, so we're the same. And so there was this idea, and they said, well, can we do that? And I said, interestingly, this is a very difficult project, right? We can say what we want about the flavor or lack thereof from major market brands, but they're extremely consistent and their technical ability is very high. So it was a good challenge for our team to say, all right, how can we do that. And I firmly believe that really beautiful lager beer is managed in the cellar, right? We can do a lot of work to extract sugar from grain, but honestly, it's not terribly difficult. It's a mechanical process. It's a biological process that I think really separates beautiful lager beer from okay lager beer. There's a lot of brewers out there making really solid beers. Our goal was to make one that if you were the consumer of a mass market product and you picked it up, you would find a flavor profile that you identified with. Rippingly clean. But in our case, we want to make sure that there's still some actual flavor in beer. So, you know, part of the reason I'm passionate about lager beer in general is I cut my craft beer teeth working with and for a man named Alan Young, famously of the Chez Bay Brewery in Northern Virginia many years ago. Alan recently retired, and he has the funniest retirement business card I've ever seen, which basically says, "Hi, my name is Alan. If you have questions about beer, call somebody."
Nice.
He trained a lot of us. He trained a lot of us to make beer. You know, and so he's the one who got me into the craft beer world as a commercial brewer on the craft side. And I didn't understand at the time that he brought me in that it was very unusual in the early 90s for craft brewery to make lager beer. And he was a very talented person. And I've had great joy in my career to work with people from large breweries all across the globe and to read a bunch of great literature and to do a lot of great scientific work around how to pick the right yeast and manage it carefully. And the beauty about the state of our current industry is that the technology that we need to do this, good cooling, right, good lautering, good boiling, they're available to us and great yeast. I think there's a lot of really good choices, but for me, it's the Weihenstephan 3470. It's a workhorse. I think that sometimes craft brewers will try too hard here. And you know, what's the famous YE strain that we all used in the late 80s and the early 90s? Like with 2206 or 2006, their Bavarian strain. I think it's either Ondex or Augustine. You know, no yeast supplier will tell you that. They'll say it's like
yeah
the breed that you get. But I've made beer with probably lager beer specifically, but probably 20 different strains. And I keep coming back to this yeast because
the Weihenstephan strain is a great strain.
Oh, so good, yeah. Right? You know, have you fermented with it?
Yeah, I have. It's fantastic. Yeah, it's great. I was going to ask you though, how do you get the carbs low? You know, because you're building basically a low carb, low cal beer, right? To make a lot light lager, kind of yep. Like the light beers that the big guys sell.
Exactly.
What's the secret for that?
Well, for me, it's a three parter. First is I don't stress about it too much. I think the marketing team. I have a great marketing team. They're awesome people, and they're like, hey, we want to innovate by having you do this thing, and I'm like, let's start with beautiful beer, right? Let's make the beer taste amazing. And then we can talk about whether or not there's room inside of that conversation to get rid of the carbs. But again, it's mostly an attenuation conversation. We are using the same beautiful North American Pilsner malt. And in this case, we're talking about a malt that looks like continental Western Indian malt. You know, I'm not always a brand guy, but I think that the Sabine and Thomas Krauss Weyermann, it really did us a service by showing us in America, especially craft brewers, what beautiful Western European Pilsner malt looks like. And for many years, I've worked for breweries that were fortunate enough to have purchased that product, but it's pretty darn expensive. And no offense to them, they're awesome people and they're amazing people. But the maltsters in North America have done a great job of figuring out that we're pretty good customers too. And it's funny, in the early days, I would talk to maltsters and I'm coming back to lager, I promise. And they would say, well, we can't sell malt to you. And I would say, well, why? And they'd say, well, we can't make any money selling malt to small breweries. And I said, well, walk me through that because we have a checkbook and we want to buy malt. And then you sell it to us, we give you money. And they said, well, for the margins that we get from our commodity customers, it doesn't make sense for us to sell you 200, 400, 800 pounds of malt. And I said, charge us more. And I was talking to one of the larger maltsters, and he was like, what? And I'm like, I don't care about 32 versus 42 cents a pound. And don't, by the way, don't tell my supplier I'm saying. Right. I'm like, what I need is access because we need to sell beer. So I think that the malt business in North America specifically came around on that to the point where we can buy beautiful specialty malt from even the larger commodity malt. And I'm stoked about that. So for me to get where we need to be on carbs and calories or where our marketing team would like us to be on carbs and calories, we start with the idea that we're going to buy beautiful ingredients, because while it is possible under certain circumstances to build a really beautiful beer out of okay ingredients, it's a whole lot easier to make really beautiful beer out of really beautiful ingredients. So again, the North American Pilsner malt, and here's the other magic to this beer: 5% flaked maize in the product, again to lighten the body and to keep the attenuation where it is. But other than that, that's it, right? And a pretty rigorous mash regimen. And by rigorous, I don't necessarily mean that we're working really hard. I mean that we wait. You got to be patient, in my experience with lager beer. So we mash at a temperature that I think a lot of people would understand, 149 to 150 degrees Fahrenheit. So the low end of the brewer's window. Again, even this malt, which is a slightly under, to call it under modified, it's not fair, slightly less modified than even craft domestic two-row blend, it is so enzymatically powerful that one need only wait, and you're going to get really great attenuation. Then, of course, you know, careful boiling, and we use a very traditional German and specifically Bavarian hopping schedule. So we're 90-minute boils almost always, with rare exceptions. Early boil for bitterness, 15-ish minutes for flavor, and whirlpool for aroma hops. In this beer, but making sure we're coagulating the bad proteins and getting that stuff out of the way. And if we're careful about the selection of malt and get the corn right, then we end up with a decently low amount of carbs and calories out of the gate. But still have enough protein to leave behind some head retention and enough of that character from the malt that's grassy and grainy, beautiful to get the flavor we want. And also, we keep the alcohol down, right? So, you know, we're a little heavy for a light beer at 4.2% alcohol by volume. You know, I think a lot of people are familiar with 3.8 or even as low as 3.2 in the style category. It's not unusual. So we're a little bit on the high end, but by mashing carefully and for long periods of time, boiling carefully, the correct adjuncts mostly to accentuate flavor, and then the right pitch of good, healthy yeast.
I wanted to ask you about fermentation. We're running a little bit low on time, but you mentioned fermentation is really the key to a great light lager. And so what are some of the tips you have on that?
Well, the first is choose carefully your strain. And I've already told you what my current favorite is, although I do believe that other strains can make really beautiful beer. I am familiar with that strain's picadillos, right? Lager yeast is a little fussy, and it wants care and attention. You know, I think all of us have brewed beer with Chico for years. Pretty much you can throw sugar at and it'll eat, and there you go. Lager yeast wants to be told that's very pretty yeast, and it wants to be handled carefully. So first, we pitch at about 2 million per milliliter per degree plate, right? So we are pitching about 24 million per milliliter into 12-plate beer, 20 million into 10-plate beer. And that's a pretty aggressive pitch, but I think it matters. We knock out and ferment relatively cold for the style category. So we're knocking out at 50 degrees Fahrenheit, and we are doing primary fermentation at 52 degrees Fahrenheit. And I think that really matters, right? So good, healthy pitch. Oxygen matters. You know, we want the yeast to be healthy. We don't want to over aerate the wort. We don't want to bloom too much yeast. We're looking for between 10 and 12 parts per million dissolved oxygen. A little more than you might get from just using ambient air, but certainly nowhere near what one can get if you really pound and compressed breathing grade oxygen product. And then we will do primary fermentation at that temperature. On our 10 Plato beers, we lose about a Plato a day if we're doing a good job. When we get about halfway to terminal, though, we are beginning to slowly ramp the temperature up with a goal, and it's hard for us to do this throughout the year, but in the summer it's pretty easy, of ending fermentation or ending primary fermentation at about 62 degrees Fahrenheit. Chris White has a really beautiful treatise on this in his book about yeast, where he talks about basically, this is a diacetyl rest, right? This strain is famous for not producing large quantities of diacetyl, which I appreciate. But the beer still needs, in my opinion, to roll up through that temperature range. And not only does it tend to get the yeast to clean up some of the longer chain sugars that it might have been ignoring, and to help that there not be diacetyl and to reduce acetaldehyde into non-flavor compounds. But it really drives the attenuation up in, for me, we're looking for attenuation numbers up into the 90s. So we end close to one Plato on that beer. And that really pulls the card, right? And if we've managed the alcohol carefully, so we're landing just a little over 100 calories for 12 ounces. And I don't have the carb number in front of me, but I remember we sent it out because one of our team members was like, well, I'm interested in that. And I don't care too much about that. But the marketing department was like, we could use that information too. And when the number came back, everybody was like, it's really low. And I'm like, well, we didn't put that many carbs in it in the first place. So it's not a complete surprise, but go team. Yeah. Right. And then the last thing about the yeast is, of course, we cool back down from 62 after we've had a solid rest there and done a little screening for the diacetyl is a good long cold aging period where we were constantly removing the yeast. I think brewers sometimes get a little lazy and they're like, hey, we'll crash the tank and then we'll pull the yeast when we get to it. And I think that if you give the beer a little bit more time and attention, if you're slow and careful about bringing that temperature down and you're thoughtful about the removal of yeast, right? Because we still want some yeast to be in contact with the beer, but we use cylinder conical fermenters, which are famous for creating hot spots that kill yeast. And again, lager yeast is a little temperamental. We want to make sure that that yeast is not dying, autolyzing, and negatively impacting all that flavor that we work so hard to get in the beer. So we crop for repitch about day 10, so up for diacetyl rest. I got that trick from a friend of mine, and it turns out to be really wonderful. It's kind of antithetical to cooling and collecting yeast, right? Like you're going to collect yeast at the warmest portion of the ferment, but that gives me the most vital and most viable yeast for the repitch.
Right.
And it keeps our count high because we need a lot of yeast to pitch beer. And then I will not release this beer without a full 28 days of cold aging. There's no substitute, you know. Urquell famously is 13 weeks, 3 months of aging. And there's a reason. It works, you know. Also, lager yeast, even the little bit that gets left behind, it gets a little lazy, and we're looking for pretty aggressive attenuation. We find if we wait, we might get enough, you know, by the time we're into nearly freezing temperatures, we might still be around 2 Plato. We'll get that last Plato reduction out of the beer if we're just patient, you know. So taking care of the yeast, being thorough and patient and timely. And I think I've got a great team because I'm like, listen, we're going to have to touch these tanks every single day and sometimes twice. And that's a lot. I mean, we're all busy, right? We've got a lot of paperwork to do. We've got a lot of raw goods to order. We've got a lot of people to manage. But the proof is in the pint. We're really proud of the product. And I also feel like that, you know, as my team saw the development of the product come together, they were like, oh, now I get it. We can be thoughtful and intentional here and build a beautiful beer that a lot of people dismiss because they're like, it's not done that flavor, right? And famously, there are a lot of craft breweries out there who, even when they go down this route, they don't, you know, they may not care as much about that product as they do about some of their other beers. And so it gets short shrift. Awesome. And unfortunately, you can taste it, you know.
Hey, Larry, we are running low on time. I'd love to have you back, though, sometime. But can you quickly tell us where Crooked Hammer is located? I know you got multiple locations. Yep. And also, maybe just a word or two about some of your other offerings.
Yeah, absolutely. So the company I work for is La Vida Hospitality, and the brewpub brand we have is Crooked Hammock Brewery. I'm the director of brewing operations for Crooked Hammock, and currently we have 3 locations. So our original location is in Lewis, Delaware, on Route 9. Our second location is in Middletown, Delaware, so northern Delaware, not quite to the beach, but beach adjacent. And then our current largest location is in North Myrtle Beach at Barefoot Landing. You can find our products there. We offer a full lineup of beers at our brew pubs, which I'm pretty stoked about, that run the range from light lager all the way through wild ferment sour beer. and barrel aged products. We have, excuse me, our goal is to have a product for you no matter what style it is you drink. And we usually have somewhere between 12 and 14 products on draft with another half a dozen products in hand. Of course, we're full service brew pubs, but one of the things that I will mention about our brand that I think is unique and very interesting is we're about the backyard and the backyard cookout. And almost all of our locations include really large exterior spaces, which is awesome, especially because we're at the beach. You know, we really lean into, if you're here for the outside weather, let's experience it. And I hope that people who are listening to the podcast get a chance to come by and check out one of the beers we talked about.
Well, Larry, I really appreciate you being on the show, and thank you so much for being here.
Brad, my pleasure.
And my guest today was Larry Horowitz. He's the head brewer at Crooked Hammock Brewing, and he's also a longtime beer judge. Thank you again, Larry.
There you go.
A big thank you to Larry Horowitz for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the American Homebrewers Association. The Homebrewers Association invites you to create your own brew venture. Join for 1 year and select a free brewing book from more than 60 titles to match your fermentation goals. Visit homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith to get that special offer. Again, that's homebrewersassociation.org/beersmith, and you can join the American Homebrewers Association and get your new brewing book. And finally, Beersmith Web, the online version of Beersmith brewing software. Beersmith for the Web lets you design great beer recipes from any browser, including your tablet or phone. Edit recipes on the go with the same suite of recipe building tools as our desktop version. Try Beersmith Web today by creating a free account at beersmithrecipes.com. And finally, a reminder to click that like or subscribe button on YouTube, iTunes, Spotify, or whatever platform you're listening on. Clicking that button is a great way to support the show. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.